from New York, it's The Gary Nall Show. And now, your host, Gary Nall.
Got my mojo working, but just gonna work on you.
I'm Gary Nall. Nice to have you with us today. Today, the power and control of secretive, autonomous, and unaccountable national security elites over the nation's decision-making regarding war and peace. My guest will be Dr. Scott Horton. Dr. Horton is an attorney and contributing editor to Harper's Magazine, lectures at Columbia University Law School. His specialty is national security issues, armed conflict, human rights, and international law. He is the recipient of the National Magazine Award, and he is a lifetime human rights advocate, and he served as the legal counsel for Andriy Sakharov and Elena Bonner. So he is a champion among human rights activists in the former Soviet Union. He is also the former president of the International League for Human Rights and co-founder of the American University in Central Asia. So that will be an interesting discussion. You won't want to miss that. Let's begin. It was about 7 years ago that I received, my guest information, as I do every day. And we try to plan our guests about a month out. We do a lot of research on the guest, making sure they don't have any conflicts of interest, what their positions are, to see that these people at least maintain objectivity and have something relevant and cutting edge to share with us. We don't like having the same guests on, as many programs do. It's just boring. You get to know what they're going to say. I remember when I'd watch Keith Olbermann, I knew exactly what Eugene Robinson would say, how he would say it, and you just zone out because there's nothing new. No one's going to take a chance. No one's going to do original work that allows them to step over the line and say, hold on a second, there's something relevant here. And even what I liked about Olbermann is I liked his commentaries. I thought he did the best commentaries in the media, bar none. Right behind him, I would have put a few other people, Bill Moyers, right up there as well. And still, he does great commentaries. So I had a person on the show, and they kept harping against soy. And it's okay if you want to say that a specific study shows something wrong with soy, fine. But all soy being attacked all the time, as if there's no study showing that it's good, then there's some other agenda. So I asked this to the guest. There were two medical doctors. I said, have either of you now or in the past received any money from any foundation or special interest group associated with the meat or dairy lobby? With that, they left the show. Literally stopped. As it turns out, they both were associated with a foundation that is pro-meat, pro-dairy, and vehemently opposed to soy. So then there was a scientist claiming that there was no good evidence in support of soy. So I said, come on and debate me. And he said yes. So we did a debate, an hour debate, and in that debate he laid out his arguments against soy. And then I proceeded to share 5,000 studies from the independent peer-reviewed literature, excluding any that had been sponsored by anything involving soy that could bias it, showing the benefits of soy. We're talking about non-GMO organic soy. From all the different scientific literature, he had, I think, 5 studies. And indeed, if you had a really high soy diet and you had goiter, that would be very problematic. It would affect your thyroid gland because your thyroid would already be compromised. But at no time is anyone suggesting or should suggest, it wouldn't be reasonable or responsible, that soy should be what you eat all the time. Rather, soy foods as a part of a healthy diet are extremely beneficial, especially the fermented soy like miso or natto or even tempeh. These are loaded with probiotics and help reestablish good gut bacteria, but there's also phytonutrients and isoflavones in soy that help women. So from my perspective, I see how people can cherry-pick literature all the time, and they just did it with homeopathy. They excluded 121 good studies that would meet any quality criteria, double-blind, placebo-controlled, with statistically significant benefits using homeopathy, and you just wipe them all away. None exist. And then you use studies that don't show any benefit. That's bad science, but that's not unintentional. Someone had to decide that that was their intent. And I see this all the time. And by the time that filters down from someone who has been told this is what we want you to do, who has decided that's what they're going to do, we're going to bias a story to a reporter reporting on it without doing any original research. The public then is fed misinformation. That said, this is just the latest in this development. This is a quote, men who eat soy can have a lower lung cancer risk. Quote, soy contains isoflavones, which act similarly to the hormone estrogens and may have anti-cancer qualities and hormone-related cancers of the breast and prostate. The BBC says this. Now, what we know in this audience is that cells in the lungs have properties that suggest they also respond to the flavones. And researchers studied more than 36,000 men and more than 40,000 women, 45 to 74 years of age, and free of cancer at the start of the study. The researchers followed the women for 11 years after surveying their food intake, and they looked at everything. And this was a long study. And overall, the cancer rates were substantially lower in those that had the soy. And the same was also true with men. So once again, add in to that 5,000 positive studies on soy, one more. Large number of people, long-term study, carefully monitoring it, and they come up with pro results. But those are people who are not eating soy every day, all day, and is their only source of nutrition. That's what has to be kept in mind. Now, a lot of people today are fearing Alzheimer's. Younger people don't fear it because they don't experience it unless it's in a grandmother, grandfather. But a whole lot of people from our generation, the baby boomers, we're very concerned because we're now seeing moms and dads and aunts and uncles who have dementia, Alzheimer's, or memory loss. And at first, we hope that it's not what it is, and we hope that, you know, with time and rest, they'll recover. But then you start seeing patterns of behavior. And one of the very first red flags you should always pay attention to is repeating a statement without any memory that they've said this to you in the very near past, even in the same conversation. Recently, I had a conversation with a person who looked fine, was not overweight, does some exercise every day, even eats at a vegetarian restaurant in Manhattan, and is conscious of their food intake. But this person repeated themselves 10 times within 20 minutes, the same identical thing. And the person who was with this person, who's with him all the time, just looked and said, it's getting worse. A year ago, this wasn't the case. Now it is. What can you do to help? So I offered up a protocol that hopefully will make a difference. And I don't care what the condition is. In fact, I was so moved by this conversation, seeing the caregiver so stressed and telling me privately that this person's whole life's changed. All the plans and goals and ideals and joys they were going to have now that they could finally take a little break, they couldn't. Now it was all day, every day. And I said, give me an example of how this stresses you. Well, the fact this person will go out and forget where they're going and then have to ask people in the street, where exactly am I? Or forget how to come home. And the person said, do you have any idea that you have to be with that person constantly? Because your fear is that this person's going to end up being taken in for psychiatric evaluation and then evaluated, and now you've got a whole lot more problems. And no medications that this person's been on has made a difference. And that's the problem. Hundreds of millions of dollars, billions of dollars are being spent with no relief at all. So I believe that all change, whether it's Alzheimer's, dementia, Parkinson's, must start in one place only. And that is complete elimination of everything that produces any form of high-level oxidative stress in the body and the brain. That means no caffeine, soft drinks, meats of any kind, refined carbohydrates, deep-fried foods, artificial sweeteners, color agents, but also cell phones, computers. When you're near a computer screen, you're getting electromagnetic pulses all the time you're in front of that computer screen. In fact, I even mentioned that the engineers at our sister stations, you're sitting there, you're getting bombarded with a massive amount of electromagnetic pulses unless the station has been progressive enough to put up some magnetic shields that do work, and people should have these in their own home. And you can go up on the internet and find about these. But people either don't know about them or don't think it makes a difference because they don't see anything, they don't feel anything. But you're not going to see radiation, ionizing radiation, you can't see, taste, smell. And the same with non-ionizing radiation with electromagnetic pulses, but they're very disrupted for our chromosomes. And the chromosomes in the brain are extremely disrupted. So when I asked this person's caregiver, I said, how often does this person use a cell phone? All day long. They're on that cell phone all day. Do they have any protective device? Do they use a speakerphone, a cord? Nope. Well, that's one thing you can do. And then I said, does this person, and I went through a list of about 30 things in their home, their office. They said, yep. Those all contribute to inflammatory processes. So just getting rid of pro-inflammatory process to the degree that we can will start to protect your body. Then the second stage is, and you do it simultaneously, you start to increase those nutrients that are known to help the body. Now, in that light, one of the ones that I've mentioned a lot, like L-carnosine, C-A-R-N-O-S-I-N-E, 1,000 milligrams twice a day, the active ingredients in green tea, 200 milligrams five times a day, ginkgo biloba, 100 to 200 milligrams twice a day, glycerol phosphorylcholine, 500 milligrams, phosphatidylserine, 200 milligrams. And now there's a whole list, and I've written about it in articles that are free that you can go up on the website. Oh, by the way, on my website, we had this is hopefully the end of this, someone who changed something on my personal website. They won't be able to do that in the future, but it blocked me from being able to go on until tomorrow when I'm putting up a whole new Facebook. And therefore, those who are friended would have to friend again. And then there'll be two other sites, so at least 30,000 people at a time can go up on the Facebook. And so we have all brand new information. I have, 50,000 pieces of information, articles, and everything else up there. So it's a major source for people to get information every day on everything that's important happening in the world, but not from the orthodox or the official position, but from a progressive position. Anyhow, you'll find a lot of articles, over 700 that I've personally written, and in it I talk about reversing brain aging. So it's not difficult. A little bit of effort, and you can have protocols, and you can follow them. But the newest thing is AMPK. And I believe that this, along with resveratrol, which comes from grapes, therefore grape juice, grapes, which are always great. In fact, I did an interview yesterday afternoon with a group of lawyers on an issue, and I was talking about what I observed in one of my visits to Italy was how many families have grapes all day long on a table, like in a bowl. Like someone else might have bananas or apples. They have grapes. And these are organic grapes, and they eat them all the time. And the seed and the skin are really the most nourishing part. And that's where you get your proanthocyanidins and your resveratrol. So the more grape juice, grape concentrate, grapes, or grape powder that you get in your body, that's the single best anti-aging thing that I know you could do. Then we have something new to add to that, and I'll make it very uncomplicated. is called AMPK, and it promotes longevity factors that can extend the lifespan in numerous organisms. Now, very basic, here's what it is. It's a signaling. It's an enzyme that serves as the body's master regulating switch. It can inhibit multiple degenerative factors, or it can revitalize aging cells. So for those of you in your 50s, 60s, 70s, and 80s, you can actually rejuvenate cells. And it's found in every cell in your body. And it either turns off many destructive effects of aging, and thus enabling cells to return to their useful vitality, especially when you're juicing and you're giving very profoundly important nutrients, phytonutrients to the body, and then you rejuvenate. And the greater AMPK, which is adenosine monophosphate activated protein kinase, that's AMPK, activation has been shown to help target damaging factors of aging. Studies show that increased AMPK activity supports reduced fat storage, new mitochondrial production, just like PPQ, and the promotion of healthy blood glucose and lipids already within normal range. And an extract of the plant, which is one of Asia's major anti-aging plants, promotes this activation. And it is, let me spell it for you, G-Y-N-O-S-T-E-M-M-A. G-Y-N-O-S-T-E-M-M-A, gynostemma, and then the second word is pentaphyllum, P-E-T-A-P-H-Y-L-L-U-M, and it promotes AMPT activation and in an amazing way. So, and then you also have from the rose hip, that little tiny red kind of tart, hard berry. That's where you get a high concentration of vitamin C. That's also good, and it helps boost AMPK. And so those are a couple of things that can make a difference. So I hope that helps you. So anyhow, if you have Alzheimer's or dementia, memory loss, one of the best things you can do, because I try to think what can help people without it being too technical? What can you do to make a difference? Well, berries. Just remember berries. Berries for dementia, berries for Alzheimer's. And that's because the phytonutrients in berries help the body break down and eliminate a lot of the amyloid plaque that is in the brain. And we have enormous amounts of research on berries. In fact, there's the ellagic acid, the anthocyanidins, the catechins, the gallic acid, the caffeic acid. All of these are found in strawberries, for example. And that decreases the cyclooxidation and increases neurological health. We have found that bilberries, B-I-L-B-E-R-R-I-E-S, bilberries, have anthocyanins, flavanol, lutein, zeaxanthin, and that helps protect your arteries and your neurons and your brain. We have found that blackberries are very high in polyphenols, and that protects the formation of beta amyloid fibrils that have been found in the brains of dementia and Alzheimer's patients. And so we've also found that the blackberry provides polyphenols with antioxidants to reduce oxidative stress, and that's good. Blueberries are really superstars with flavanols, anthocyanins, and cinnamate, and that is associated with increased memory and learning. So the evidence is overwhelming. The berries for the brain. So get as many berries as possible into the body, and it will make an enormous difference. So that's the latest on health and nutrition. Tomorrow I'm going to talk about estrogen and breast cancer and how a lot of people have got it just the opposite. And I'll explain that then. I'm Gary Knoll. Nice to have you with us today. We're going to go to our guest in about 10 minutes. And we're going to do an extended version of our interview segment. This will be a Conversations with Remarkable Minds. The power and control of secretive, autonomous, and unaccountable national security elites over the nation's decision-making regarding war and peace with Dr. Scott Horton. He is an attorney and one of the world's leading human rights activist attorneys. Lectures at Columbia University, writes for Harper's, and was the legal counsel for Andrea Sakharov and Elena Bonner and other human rights activists in the former Soviet Union. But before then, I want to take a look at some of the problems we're having in our society. And I believe that we have to have a different look at the roots of modern terrorism, because what we have now, we have Islamic-phobic gesturing all over Fox. We have those Muslims who come on there who talk about the need for boots on the ground, invading Iran. They talk about the subject as if the only solution is a military one. And then, of course, you have a lot of the Christian right who agree with that. They're pro-Zionist Christians, and they have aligned themselves with Israel. It was Pope Benedict III, by the way, he was the Pope from 855 to 858, just 3 years AD. He said, anyone who attempts to construe a personal view of God which conflicts with church dogma must be burned without pity. Now think of that. This is the most powerful person in the Christian kingdom. And he says, anyone who attempts to construe a personal view of God which conflicts with church dogma must be burned without pity. Well, and for those of you who don't believe in reincarnation, I could just see Bill O'Reilly as a pope saying this very thing. But then on the other end of that, we have Bertrand Russell, who said, fear is the basis of the whole. Fear of the mysterious, of defeat, of death. Fear is the parent of cruelty, and therefore it is no wonder if cruelty and religion have gone hand in hand. Now, I want to share something from G. Asghar Mitha. And the reason that I quoted Bertrand Russell, all you have to do is read his essay entitled Why I'm Not a Christian, delivered on March 6, 1927 to the National Secular Society, South London branch, that inspired a different look. We know that people have a right to their religious views, and religion has helped many people have a sense of meaning and purpose and community. We also know that at different times, those who've headed different religious groups have used the power that they have been given in some of the most horrific manners imaginable. The horrors of the Catholic Church are well documented, while even today the modernists and historians and politicians are turned off to discuss those horrors. They might go back as far as the pedophilia. They don't go back any further. They should. They don't even want to discuss how many popes knew of the pedophilia and hid the priest? They should. If you want a doctrine to be held more significant than the people who are running it, then have the honesty to look at the totality. I think you have an outstanding pope now, probably the best pope in memory, and not perfect. When we see women who've been ordained as priests, and when we see a lot of change, then this is not just a unique person running the church, but probably is the exemplar of all popes. But we can't get an honest discussion. No civilization has been without its dark ages. Europe and America burnt people alive by tying them to stakes after accusations of witchcraft. Ancient Egypt used to cut off limbs of their citizens from opposite ends and then crucify them. Rome, too, crucified their citizens. All kinds of horrors have been recorded in history books. And one of the best movies I've ever seen is The Name of the Rose, starring Sean Connery, regarding the Holy Inquisition involving the church. The procedures of the Holy Inquisition involve examination of charges of heresy by the church, and even those innocent were not spared by trumped-up charges. Such was the terrorism due to religious fundamentalism within the European religious system that the church reaped wealth, mainly from the poor and destitute, while protecting the wealthy aristocracy. The church was not only a religious entity, but like all of them, they're political bodies. The Spanish Inquisition from 1474 to 1834 were held under Pope Sextus IV, mainly against the Jews and the Muslims, also some Christian heretics. Those refusing to take up Catholic faith were led to the stake to be burned alive in a ceremony known as auto de fide, or act of faith, and their properties immediately confiscated to the church. The horrors of the Catholic Church are provided in brief, not to condemn the church, but rather to make us aware that almost all religions or individuals heading religions at different times can take what otherwise would be an enlightened and positive form and demean it. The basis of all terrorism and fundamentalism is not religion, but rather it is politics. Both politicians and clergy have used religion to consolidate their power over the weakest of their audience, condemning them as heretics and kafirs. By the way, the kafir is a heathen unbeliever. Now, something specific from a person who grew up in Pakistan and writing in Countercurrents, G. Asghar Mitha. While I was growing up, quote, in Pakistan until 1968, there was harmony and religious tolerance among the Shia and the Sunni sects. Christians and Hindus, too, were accepted and tolerated, and there were no Islamic laws that discriminated them. Hotels used to serve alcohol and advertise striptease shows of women from many countries. After having completed my education in the United States, I returned to Pakistan in 1977 under the martial law of the president at that time, Zia, only to find a Pakistan society devoid of all tolerance and one of extreme religious fundamentalism, but not yet visible to terrorism. It was in the germinating stages. Zia was a diehard Sunni supporter who closely held the Wahhabist Salafist belief of forcibly imposing religion upon the people. In exchange, Zia received large Saudi Arabian money to breed religious extremism among the Taliban, the students in the madrasas, which are religious schools, operated as seminaries to oust the Soviets from Afghanistan. The Saudis, in turn, received the political support from the United States. The students were not taught true Islamic values, which are based on knowledge and free learning that benefit mankind. The Wahhabist teachings are instead based upon fear, aptly described by Bertrand Russell. The other Wahhabist Salafist fundamentalist, Saudi citizen Osama bin Laden, led the Afghan Mujahideen. Mujahideen means holy warriors. And Taliban against the Soviets under the umbrella of Al-Qaeda. He was supposedly killed in Pakistan in May 2011 by the Americans. The Soviet war in Afghanistan lasted over 9 years, from December 1979 to February 1989. Zia died in August 1988. He served his masters well, and the Americans and Saudis rewarded him very handsomely. Unfortunately, I perceive the same fates of other current Pakistani leaders who are serving their masters. The Islamic State, for example, has nothing to do with religion, but everything to do with fear, cruelty, politics, and religious intolerance. ISIS does not represent Islamic moderation, tolerance, respect, and knowledge. The ISIS jihadists being recruited from Europe and North America are most likely not mainstream Muslims, but lunatics and converts in a society they hate. They could well have been victims of political and extremist religious brainwashing, similar to the Taliban, just like Al-Qaeda and Taliban were recruiting against the Soviets. The ISIS may have been recruited to plunder the Arab countries. The ISIS is conducting inquisitions against everyone, regardless of their minority, Christian or other sectarian beliefs, Shia, Sunni, and their methods of torture and murder, beheadings and burning, are as horrifying as was practiced by the European churches. Following the war's end, Afghanistan was in ruins, and those same political parties, the seven-party jihadists that had allied against the Soviets, engaged in trivial disputes and fighting amongst themselves. America abandoned Afghanistan and Pakistan only to return in 2001 with a war against the former and military threats and promises of monetary aid for the latter. The Taliban returned victorious to Pakistan after having defeated the Soviet infidels. They now believe they were God's chosen people, and like Zia, it was their bounded duty to forcibly impose Wahhabism upon a nation. Terrorism and fear became their instruments, and many of these Taliban also infiltrated the political parties in Pakistan in order to gain power and wealth, similar to the norms of the Christian Church of the Dark Ages. America watched and learned how hyenas fight over a carcass. Pakistan and Afghanistan were ushering in the Dark Ages. The lessons were going to be applied throughout the Muslim world with the objectives of once again gaining not only power but control of the precious black gold resources. Saudi Arabia and other monarchist Arab Wahhabist countries have been natural economic allies of America and its European vassals as they are weak and in need of protection. America continues to support the Saudis in exporting their perverted religious dogma across the Muslim countries in order to breed religious intolerance, cruelty, and terrorism. Some of the countries like Iraq, Libya, Syria, and Palestine have been war victims. Others like Pakistan, Jordan, and Egypt have survived upon American Saudi aid. Iran is the only Muslim country where America and the Saudi monarchy have failed to export terrorism and religious extremism, and both fear it as a regional power. The one thing common among the Arab monarchies and the Western democracy is deep hypocrisy. Just a different point of view that I'd like to share, since we seem to hear so little of that in the other media. Is the United States a fascist society? I believe it is. I believe it's been fascist, and I believe it depends upon if you are a victim of it. Just imagine this. More than $2 billion, that's with a B, billion dollars was confiscated from motorists and kept without any charges being brought, meaning the person whose money was stolen by the police when they were stopped hadn't committed no crime. They were not arrested. They were not ticketed. They simply had to give their money and sometimes cars and other people's homes to the police, who then turned around and used it for their own means, their own departments. It became a major income source. Asset forfeiture. Now, if you're a very wealthy person and someone confiscates your plane and you go to take your $50 million plane someplace and it's not there, and someone says, well, we confiscated it because we thought you might be using it to transport drugs, I can promise you that would be headline news in every major paper in the United States. If someone confiscated Lloyd Blanfein's, the head of Goldman Sachs' home in New York or Connecticut, you would hear about it. So would the State Department, the Justice Department, the Pentagon, the White House, everyone would hear about it. But what if you're just a normal person? That is the person most likely to meet America's modern creeping fascism. Most Americans are taught in school that fascism is a ruthless one-party dictatorship. The most popular example is either Nazi Germany or Franco's Italy. This is a misconception. Fascism is a political economy, not merely a political system that existed in one moment of history. Fascism is defined by black revolutionary and assassinated political prisoner George Jackson. It is the complete control of the state by monopoly capital. Fascism is the last stage of capitalism in the heart of the U.S. imperial center, where the relationship between the state and corporation becomes indiscernible. A difficult but necessary task for the left in this period is to acknowledge that fascism is the system of rule in the United States. This is according to Danny Haipong from Global Research. However, how can you acknowledge this if many of the instruments that have historically been used successfully at different times and nobly at different times are also a part of that fascistic system or benefit from it. Some of the leading corporate Democrats, those who are considered major liberals, have supported the policies of the Council on Foreign Relations, the Trilateral Commission, the Business Roundtable, different treaties, including NAFTA and GATT, and supported Bill Clinton, Hillary Clinton, Barack Obama, without looking at the consequences of what they've supported. Because all of them benefited at some level, either through the association of power or economic advantage. Look at who gets the private contracts out of Washington, D.C. Thousands every year go to people who are connected. So, in my opinion, they are part of this fascistic society. They don't have the terrible face that we expect, but they're there. The privatization of the public sector, deunionization of the entire labor force, the violent austerity are the seeds of domestically grown fascism in the economic realm. Such fascistic activity has brought about the rapid decline of political and economic conditions for the working class and the rapid accumulation of wealth and profit for the ruling class. And there are as many Democrats in the ruling class as there are Republicans. And also, please do not tell me how lacking in fascism support any of the magazines are until you can show me which of the leading liberal magazines supported Dennis Kucinich or Jill Stein, or Rocky Anderson, or the Green Party candidate, or Justice Party candidate in any of the recent major elections. Instead, they have supported full-blown card-carrying fascists. The fact you win a Nobel Prize doesn't mean you're not a fascist. Look at the consequences. Look how they make their money. Look what they support. And yet, we live with this hypocrisy. Just think of it this way. Shelters are overflowing and turning the homeless away, and yet we have 10,000 square feet of empty office space in New York City. Where are the people saying, let's turn this into homes for the homeless? The U.S. has 25% of the world's prisoners, despite only possessing 4% of the world's population. Mass joblessness. Our actual real unemployment level is between 24 and 28%. We have 100 million Americans who could work who can't find work, so they're excluded from the work statistics. We have over 200 million Americans living at, above, or below the poverty line. We have the largest number of incarcerated people for nonviolent offenses. We have homelessness that's now been made a crime in 65 communities in the United States. We have the return of debtors' prisons. And we have a complete breeding of fear of the working class. So we militarize against them, militarization of the police. And this is done by the Democrats, equal to, side by side, shoulder with, ideological, non-separated from the Republicans. Do not be confused by what a person says. Judge them by what they do. In there, they're equal. The paradox of fascism lies in its ability to sustain and grow in the midst of deteriorating conditions for the majority of the population. The racist foundation of this country is used to defend itself. The white working class steadfastly defends its privileges obtained from white imperial pillage of black and indigenous people, both here and abroad. Right now, one of the biggest movements in the world is the corporatization and privatization of natural resources in Africa. Is there any concern for the people who've lived on the property for millennia? None whatsoever. Are they being compensated? Massively. Are they working hand in hand with the corrupt fascist leaders of the African countries? Completely. That's the danger of putting sociopaths in position to power. And so the white ruling class maintains unity with the white working class because although exploitation has heightened for everyone, black and indigenous people, including undocumented migrants, remain economically and socially oppressed to a much harsher degree than whites. To ensure racism does not precipitate a racial and radical struggle between white supremacy and black freedom, the U.S. ruling class has modeled and trained a black political class. These class of neocolonial elites, with Barack Obama leading the way, works in the interest of fascism by protecting the rule of the white ruling class while teaching the entire black community that black faces in high imperial places is not only desired but also worthy of staunch defense. Furthermore, fascism relies on a racist enforcement arm to control the political direction of the oppressed. The expanded surveillance military state that currently spies, detains, wiretaps the 99% remains more dangerous and repressive for the black community. The vast majority of wiretaps, police, and vigilante murders, stop and frisk, happens to black and brown people. So instead of joining forces with the black community to build a powerful movement, exploited white Americans can still rely upon the state to enforce racism on its behalf. The U.S. corporate media and education system provide the ideological change of fascism. In this period, both systems serve as mouthpieces for U.S. imperial ambitions, values, and behaviors. Fascism is normalized in the American mind through the inculcation of racism, individualism, and the depoliticized and inaccurate conception of history and politics. The U.S. education system conditions the oppressed and oppressors into their positions in society. Black and indigenous youth attend factory schools that emphasize obedience to authority, which instills a dehumanized and subservient disposition for the future in low-wage work on prison. From K-12, black working class youth are taught to pledge allegiance to a flag of genocide and colonialism and overcrowded, police-occupied, privatized schools. While white youth, the pledge allegiance is better-funded schools, more capable of conditioning them into positions of power. However, all youth are taught a mythological version of U.S. history that applauds white supremacy, colonialism, and the capitalist development of free and democracy. The corporate media, despite being far more monopolized than the U.S. school system, provides a more diverse means of education. Corporations like CNN and the New York Times habitually lie about the facts of political events to protect the white ruling class and its institutions from accountability. Corporate hip-hop, music, and television entertainment complement corporate news syndicates by doping the mind full of mindless garbage. It matters little if the media of choice is watching Scandal, listening to Nicki Minaj on the radio, or reading the Washington Post. The boardrooms of five corporations are manufacturing consent to the U.S. fascist system. Malcolm X succinctly summarized the function of the corporate media when he said, "If you're not careful, the newspapers will have you hating the people who are being oppressed and loving the people who are doing the oppressing." Let's now go over and say hello to our guest who is standing by, Dr. Scott Horton. Nice to have you with us today.
Great to be with you, Gary.
You may have read the Associated Press's report released just yesterday that the Obama administration has set a new record for censoring government files or outright denying access to them last year. The previous year also set a new record. Secrecy has become a fundamental characteristic of this administration. The figures are extraordinary. 714,000 information requests. Among those, over 250,000 were fully denied, and claims were made that no records could be found on 215,000. $434 million was spent by the government trying to keep up with requests, and $28 million spent legal fees to keep records secret. Even after Edward Snowden's revelations that brought greater public awareness about the extent of the intelligence agency's operations, secret continues to increase rather than subside. Even when they're caught with screw-ups and breaking the law, they have an uncanny way to hide their tracks and divert attention away from public and congressional scrutiny. Now people are likely to blame Obama and this administration. However, is this White House really to blame for this lack of transparency, or is this another sector of government working more clandestinely behind the White House, which has the power to override the executive and has the final word as to what becomes public and what should remain secret?
Well, I think both of those alternatives are correct. So I think given Barack Obama's position at the apex of political power, he has responsibility for these matters. And, of course, it also reflects a paradox of his administration, because he promised during the campaign in 2008 he was going to give us the most transparent administration ever. In fact, he even offered very specific, well-targeted criticisms of the Bush administration policies dealing with Freedom of Information Act requests, and said he was going to reverse these trends and ensure that more information was available. But the facts, as this Associated Press article makes clear, have been exactly the opposite. That is, that the trend to more and more classification, the invocation of more and more secrecy surrounding government documents, particularly in the national security area, is growing. And in fact, if we track things on the straight line from the Clinton administration to today, we see it's just a straight line of ascent with no real change occurring, regardless of who holds the White House, whether it's a Democratic reformist, transparency-preaching administration, or a Republican administration that, in fact, doesn't adhere to these ideals and, in fact, worships more the mammon of secrecy. It doesn't seem to really matter. And that tells us, of course, that the bureaucracy is its own state. It's a second state underneath the one that we all learn about in civics class. It's a decision that operates by its own rules and makes its own decisions, and it uses secrecy as a lever of power. So the ability to create secret documents, to guard its own decisions and acts as secret, gives it more political power within the system in Washington today. That's the core fact at the bottom of secrecy.
I appreciate that insight. Thank you. How close are the relationships between the masters of secrecy within the government and private contractors? If members of Congress can constantly have the wool pulled over their eyes, resulting in passivity towards hiding torture, the extent of drone operations and spying on American public, then it's fair to say that the lobbyists for the private intelligence industry are working on NASA's, the National Security Agency and the CIA and other agencies' behalf to undermine congressional oversight.
Well, I think the key fact in our national security and intelligence community is the revolving door between the upper echelons of the agencies and the contractors. So we see a small echelon of individuals, a couple of thousand of them, who occupy the senior-most positions in these major agencies and the Department of Defense. And those individuals serve some time in government service, and then revolve out to sit on the boards and have senior office positions in the contractors. And if we look, one of the most important phenomena to have occurred since the end of the Vietnam War is this change in the budget relationship between contractors and the U.S. government, particularly the National Security and Intelligence Community. So if we look at the situation, say, in the 1970s, 1980s, most of the budget went to went for the use of the agencies themselves on their own staff, their own research, their own development, their own record keeping. Since the end of the Cold War, particularly since about 1995, there has been a sharp shift so that that money now goes less and less to pay salaries of U.S. government employees, and maintain office overhead and do work within the government, and now into the hands of contractors. So we're talking about more than $500 billion a year for the last several years that has gone towards contractors. That's a historical high water mark, and it means less government control over this money as well. So huge chunks of the budget, a large, enormous share of the discretionary budget, goes into the hands of contractors serving the military and national security industry. I'll just give you one way to show what this has meant in terms of shift of wealth within the country. So if we look at that same period of time and we look at the Census Bureau's determination of what are the wealthiest standard metropolitan statistical areas within the country, we see the rise in exactly this period of time of the Washington D.C. suburban area, that includes Washington, Maryland, and parts of Northern Virginia, as the wealthiest metropolitan area in the country. And that is largely on the basis of wealth transfer to U.S. government contractors leading the pack defense and intelligence community contractors who are overwhelmingly based within 100 miles of Washington, D.C.
When we look back at history, we find those countries and institutions that were most fanatical about intelligence gathering of their populations were also the most despotic and tyrannical. The Inquisition during the Middle Ages to reveal heretics to church doctrine is perhaps the first major international intelligence gathering operation. The Nazis, the Tsotsis, the Chinese Cultural Revolution, and regimes of dictatorships relied heavily upon secretive surveillance. So secretive spying upon entire populations is contrary to a democracy. So what does this say about the kind of government we have in Washington today? Is it realistic to even call our system of government a democracy anymore, aside from the national ritual of voting on election day? And second, for a true democracy, what forms of secretive operations do you believe are acceptable and legitimate?
Well, in fact, when we look at secrecy, it makes sense to look at a triangle of three different concepts. One is secrecy, one is privacy, and the third is publicity. So secrecy, things that the government can keep secret from its people. Privacy, things that individuals are entitled to keep secret from the government and other individuals. Publicity, things that the government must make public. And from the time of the ancient Greeks, political theorists have looked at this triangle and say, you know, quite independent of other considerations, this is a way of testing any society and telling us whether that society, in fact, is democratic or authoritarian or even totalitarian. So a truly democratic society does not treat these three values equally. It puts the greatest emphasis on publicity. In fact, ensuring that the citizens have access to all the basic information they need to make decisions about their future. Whereas a totalitarian society places very strong emphasis on secrecy. So it offers a compact to its subjects, namely, we will keep everything secret, but we will keep you safe. We will offer you security. And in exchange, you have no privacy, and we have no duty to give you any information to make decisions, because you have no real role in decision-making. And if we look at what's been going on in the United States, certainly in the last 15 years, we see that this triangle is tilting very decisively, so that the space given to secrecy has exploded, the space for privacy has contracted dramatically, and publicity is fading as well. So that would suggest that America is much less democratic today than it's been in other points in its past. In fact, in my book I say, a Greek from 4th, 5th century Athens coming to America today would not say this is a democratic society. We say we're democratic because every 4 years we choose a leader, based on well-groomed and carefully prepared candidates. But, of course, for a Greek from the classical period, that would not be democracy at all. In fact, that would be consistent with what they call tyranny. So kings or tyrants were frequently selected through a process like this. Democracy is individual citizens making the call about all the issues that matter to them. So it relates to popular involvement in decisions about policy and law. And that is just fading away in America, and particularly in the national security sector, where people are more poorly informed than ever before and have less say about when we go to war or when we don't.
My final question is, it concerns how the major American media appears complicit in protecting and sidestepping coverage of the elite's secrecy. What relationship can be confirmed between the major media and the intelligence agencies, such as the media fails dismally to properly report on corruption within the intelligence community? And let's look at the Bush administration. It made it more difficult for whistleblowers to come forth, and the current Obama administration has further exacerbated the problem by clearly engaging in a war against anyone wanting to tell the truth about what the government's doing criminally or wrong. So why aren't more coming forth publicly, or at least within approved government channels, to reveal improprieties and law-breaking? And they're not doing it.
Well, let me say, I think if we look at the Senate Select Committee on Intelligence's report on torture and black sites, to to me, the single most striking, the most shocking thing in that report was its very detailed discussion of the role that's played by the media in these matters, and particularly the CIA's very sophisticated and very effective campaign of manipulating major American media. And the Senate committee went out of its way to document this, naming names and saying some hugely embarrassing things about major print media and broadcast media. But I think what it shows is the intelligence community is very sophisticated. They understand how commercial media in America work. They understand that reporters want to have sources inside the intelligence community to be able to get scoops, and that in order to secure those relationships, they will skew their own reporting and they will allow themselves to be manipulated by the intelligence community. So what the report documents is a systematic polluting of the waters, where the CIA was leaking information and having it published in major media, and this information was simply not true. It was a propaganda line that the CIA was putting out. So there's a failure of objectivity, a failure of criticism, and a failure to do really diligent, serious journalism. But that being said, you know, we got to say there are good journalists out there too. They're people who are brave, courageous, and who take risks to get out good stories. I mean, there are people like Seymour Hersh who, you know, has a history going back 40 years.
He is the best. He is terrific.
And there are quite a few others who are doing it. I mean, I'd say right now, Glenn Greenwald and his colleagues at The Intercept are playing a leading role. There's Jay Mayer at The New Yorker. There's a number of very, very good journalists. But I would say for all of that, the core of what you call corporate media, I think correctly, the quality of reportage is weak, and it's particularly, it's just not critical. And that results in Americans being frequently actually misinformed about major projects of the intelligence community, misinformed about projects they're running in places like Pakistan and Yemen, where these things are accurately reported in the media in Europe and other places. They're just not reported in the United States accurately, and this is a very dangerous development.
Thank you very much, Dr. Scott Horton, for sharing these insights. We appreciate it. The book is Lords of Secrecy, The National Security Elite and America's Stealth Warfare. I'm Gary Nall. Thank you all for listening. Look forward to sharing more on tomorrow's program. Have a nice day, everyone.